content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the December 19, 2025 online edition of the New Yorker. Can you reclaim your mind? To feel mentally alive, you have to do more than defeat distraction, by Joshua Wathman. Looking back over the columns I've written in 2025, I can see that a lot of them, broadly construed, have been about reclaiming one's mind. I wrote about living in the present, picturing the future, and exploring one's memories, about reading, learning, and making the most of one's spare time, and about whether artificial intelligence will end up expanding our thinking or limiting it. The shared subject was resistance to the forces, malevolent or inertial, that can render us mentally exhausted and scattered. I guess I'm not the only person who thinks their mind needs to be reclaimed. For that reason, there's no need to get into what it needs reclaiming from. We all have our own stories of attentional woe. Suffice it to say that, like many people, I've been on what seems a years-long quest to establish a greater degree of mental sovereignty. We live in a heavy, technologized culture, and so it's natural to pursue mental reclamation through digital purification. Like my colleague, J. Caspian Kang, I quit looking at almost all social media this year. It was getting wrecked by AI anyway. I considered replacing my smartphone with a dumb phone, a device with little or no internet connectivity, but instead hobbled it using various apps and devices. I largely replaced my laptop with an e-ink tablet made by the Norwegian company Remarkable. It has no browser or email, but lets me write and annotate with both a keyboard and a stylus. Most of my columns now start life in longhand. And at home, I moved my computer out of my main workspace and into a separate room. Now, if I want to go online, I have to walk there. I like gadgets, and so, at times, my digital detox has verged on technophilic decadence. A few months ago, I bought a cheap but fun MP3 player, loaded it with a few dozen albums, and began listening to them on rotation. I figured this was better than grazing on endless Apple Music. Although I blocked most of my smartphone apps, I still use AI, not for companionship, but for projects. Recently, I've been having chatbots teach me about music production so that I can make songs in GarageBand on the computer in the other room and listen to them on my MP3 player. All of which is to say that cultivating a healthy, creative digital life can easily become an absorbing pursuit unto itself. It's a little like setting out to clean your house and then growing interested in interior design. You might start recluttering your house with new, tasteful objects. The bad distractions are mostly gone. The question is, now what? At least in my case, taming technology hasn't led directly to a reclaimed mind. I turned 46 this year, and apart from being underslept, I have no midlife complaints. I have a loving family, a rewarding job, fitness, energy, and more. But my mind feels a little something. Vague, inflexible, out of shape. In my interior world, I've noticed a growing tendency toward stasis, which digital distractions may have helped me ignore. Year by year, life's demands have built and ramified, and I've focused more and more on being efficient. I've increasingly found contentment in moving quickly from A to B to C. I suspect that I've become trapped in the amber of my previous thoughts. Lock up your libraries if you like, but there is no gate, no lock, no bolt that you can set upon the freedom of my mind, Virginia Woolf wrote in A Room of One's Own. On the other hand, sometimes we are our own jailers, In modern fiction, Wolfe asks readers to consider an ordinary mind on an ordinary day. Such a mind receives a myriad of impressions, trivial, fantastic, evanescent, or engraved with the sharpness of steel. And together, these form a luminous halo. Life, basically, in all its strangeness and mystery. A writer who could base his work upon his own feeling and not upon convention might stretch himself to describe that life. But most, Wolfe observed, simply went along with the accepted style. They'd internalized conventions, rules, habits, and ideas, restraining their own minds. Modernists like Wolfe developed an attitude, which T.S. Eliot called impersonality, meant to reclaim their mental lives from the habits they unknowingly followed. The philosopher Raymond Goyce has a story that captures the idea nicely. Goyce recalls a mentor, a schoolteacher of his, dispensing advice about becoming a visual artist. "Set aside half an hour or 45 minutes a day," the mentor said, "and then draw while ignoring all the exercises and principles and things one might have learned. Afterward, instead of judging your drawing, look at it and say to yourself, 'So, this is what I do on a day like this.'" That's not unlike observing how a river looks after a heavy rain, Goyce explains. You might say that's how the Hudson looks on a rainy day. And you might notice that this is the kind of drawing you make when you're sad, or elated, or apprehensive, or when money's tight, or when you've just played with your kids, called your mom, gone for a run, or watched one battle after another. Impersonality is one of those big ideas that scholars can elucidate forever. It sounds abstract, but on some level it has a simple meaning: seeing yourself less as a fixed point and more as a container. In her book, Tiny Experiments, How to Live Freely in a Goal-Obsessed World, the writer Anne-Laure LeCompte identifies the self-consistency fallacy as the assumption that I have always acted in a certain way, therefore I must continue to act in this way. She suggests making adventurous pacts with yourself and seeing where they lead. You're not a musician, but you can still decide to write a song every week for 6 weeks. You're not a poet, but you can still try writing a poem every day for 10 days. You've never started a business, but you can still sell something on Etsy. Maybe it will turn out that actually you are a musician, writer, or entrepreneur. But why focus on what you are? It might be enough to find that for a few minutes here and there, your mind can contain music, poetry, and ambition. Something new can happen in that quiet room. Truman Capote titled his first novel, Other Voices, Other Rooms. The book is about a teenage boy who, after a family tragedy, goes to live in a faraway house with relatives he hardly knows. The title evokes the discovery, in adolescence, that the world is full of strangers with their own concerns, the knowledge that life is full of secret stories and languages, and the understanding that, in society, the voices we know would be drowned out if we could hear the ones that go unheard. It also captures a sense of possible transformation. Of his protagonist, Capote writes, "A flower was blooming inside him, and soon, when all tight leaves unfurled, when the noon of youth burned whitest, he would turn and look, as others had, for the opening of another door." If, like me, you're decades past adolescence, it can be hard to remember the scary thrill of hearing other voices in other rooms. You may no longer want to hear them. There's something to be said for laying down rugs, hanging curtains, and listening intently to what's happening in the specific room you happen to inhabit. Still, feeling a little too well insulated I've had my ear to the wall. I've been eavesdropping on my friend Jay, who's taught himself a new art form, and on W, a musician I know whose unself-conscious, intuitive creativity I've long admired, among others. Psychologists and guidance counselors talk about role models, but that's not quite what I'm after. In an essay called The Good of Friendship from 2010, the philosopher Alexander Nahamas notes that our friends don't necessarily act in ways that inspire us. In fact, hanging out with them often involves activities that are trivial, commonplace, and boring. Nevertheless, our friendships offer us opportunities to try different ways of being. That's closer. What does it really mean to be in charge of your own mind? In many aspects of life, it's easier to say what we don't want than it is to say what we do. We don't want to be screen-addled, apocalypse-minded, nervous wrecks, incapable of reading for more than a quarter of an hour at a time. Fair enough. But who do we want to be? Maybe we just want to be people for whom that's a live question. Reclaiming your mind might come down to reasserting your right to wonder what it's for. And now from the fiction section of the December 15th, 2025 issue of The New Yorker, Understanding the Science by Camille Bordas. Everyone thinks they're on this big journey now, Debbie said, refilling her glass. I've had it with the journey. I've had it with you people. Well, I don't think I'm on a journey, Bert said. Self-discovery, Debbie added. What a joke. Life's too short to find out who we really are. It was the first time the six of them had got together for dinner in more than a year since Maria's diagnosis. And after such a long time, and in celebration of Maria's remission, they'd expected to have more interesting things to tell one another, deeper things. But they were entering dessert territory now. A cake was on the table, and only superficial topics had been broached. Irvin's promotion, Jane and Bert's move to the suburbs, Catherine's recent purchase of a metabolism tracking device, a pen-shaped item, and the cause of Debbie's rant. How much can you know about yourself exactly, she said. The therapy, the vision quests, the birth charts. Do we really need the data on metabolic flexibility, too? Jane, in Catherine's defense, said that the more you knew about yourself, the more useful you could be to society. B.S., Debbie said. I call B.S. Knowing whether Cat is in fat or carb-burning mode, that doesn't help anyone. As a result of Catherine declining cake 5 minutes earlier, no one had touched it. No one, Debbie included, really wanted to. They'd all overeaten already, drunk too much, made private plans to atone for it the next day. The cake presented a challenge. It sat there taunting them. And Debbie knew this, that you could not serve cake to a group of 40-somethings without causing ripples. But what else could she have done? Not offer dessert? She got it. No one wanted to put on weight. But this was a gorgeous princess cake. Just gorgeous. She had to drive all the way to Andersonville to get it from that Swedish bakery everyone talked about. Staring at it now, though, she wondered if the cake didn't look a little bit like a tit. The smooth half-sphere, the small pink marzipan flower nippling the top of it. And, oh God, did Maria think it looked like a tit? Did Maria still have nipples? Debbie had been meaning to look it up, what exactly it was they took in a mastectomy, but she hadn't had the nerve. I'm not on a journey, Catherine said. I just want to lose a few pounds. Back in the summer, she'd met a pretty famous actor at a friend's gallery in L.A., and they'd been dating long distance ever since. The actor was a little younger than her. She didn't want people to think they looked wrong together. He was about to come to Chicago for a 6-week shoot. It would be the first time they were in the same city for more than a few days. Catherine changed the subject to the documentary she'd just seen about flat earthers. But this topic, too, made Debbie angry. Debbie's anger at flat earthers turned out to run deeper, in fact, than her anger at metabolism tracking devices. It was one thing to feel the earth was flat, she said, but that anyone could believe that a secret of this magnitude could have been kept from the public by scientists and governments for centuries, for millennia even, no one could keep a secret for that long. Didn't people understand this? Why would Pythagoras have lied about the earth being round, she said. And Aristotle? Why go to the trouble of pretending to measure the planet's diameter, going out planting sticks, tracking shadows? Maybe they just wanted to impress their wives, Bert said. Were those guys even married, Catherine said. Weren't they all gay? Debbie rolled her eyes. She happened to know a lot about the Greek wives. Pythias had been a scientist. On her honeymoon with Aristotle, she gathered materials for an encyclopedia they were working on together. Theano, Pythagoras's wife, had been a mathematician in her own right. Maria hadn't said anything in a while. It hadn't occurred to her that the cake looked like a tit. She didn't care how accomplished certain wives had been 30 centuries ago, and she hadn't seen the Flat Earth documentary. She couldn't understand why such a documentary existed in the first place. Why someone would bother filming idiots displaying their idiocy. There was something repulsive about it, wasn't there? About ridiculing people, amplifying their dumb beliefs, so that upper middle class Chicagoans like her and her friends could feel alarmed and superior. Most things were aesthetically repulsive to her, if Maria was honest. Her aging friends certainly were. Not so much their appearance. They used the retinol creams and popped the antioxidants. They dyed their hair. They exercised. But their thoughts. Had they always been so small? Maria was getting bored of them. She was getting bored of herself, too. But what could you do? You could do one thing, Maria knew, but she didn't have the guts. And even though she'd thought of suicide as a teen, it had surprised her how determined she'd been to survive cancer, to see the world through. Those were the words that had appeared in her head when she'd been diagnosed. And then Debbie said, and Erastothenes was killed by the man whose wife he was sleeping with. So maybe bisexual. All those Greek guys, but definitely not straight up gay. Who cared who'd been what and who slept with whom? Maria wondered. But she knew what that everyone did. Everyone but her cared about those two things. She was the outlier. She was so bored that she started wondering what she would take in a fire. She knew what she would take in a fire at Catherine's place, but what would she save from Deb and Irvin's apartment if it went up in flames right at this moment? There wasn't much to get excited about. Everything matched. Nothing begged to be noticed. Kat's apartment was much nicer, Maria thought. She wished they were having dinner at Kat's. There was art on the walls there, real art by real painters, not painters whose names anyone recognized yet, but soon. Kat was the best of that lot, really. After Maria's diagnosis, Kat had offered everything she could, a shoulder to cry on, chemo drives, pharmacy runs, ice cream deliveries. Maria said no to all, but still, she appreciated the effort. She appreciated that Kat had kept trying, too, offering stranger and stranger services as the weeks went on. She could do Maria's nails if she wanted. She could read to her. She could teach her piano. The idea of piano lessons offended Maria at first, that she could be expected to learn a new skill while dealing with cancer. Wasn't cancer itself enough to learn from, she thought? What else could be asked of her? Was she supposed to master Mandarin as well, meet new people? Yet, mere hours after the piano suggestion, Maria was in the shower, once again fighting the urge to feel the lump. Had it grown? Was it shrinking? And when she extended her arms as far away from her body as possible, pleading with the fingers at the end of them to stay still and not touch, to refrain from palpating, from inquiring, she realized, one, how thin her fingers had become, and two, that giving them something to do might not be such a bad idea. She started going to Katz on Mondays and Thursdays for piano lessons, skipping only 1 week when she went in for her mastectomy. Now that she was in remission, she wondered if Kat would want to keep teaching her. Already, Kat was less available, but that had to do with the new boyfriend, Maria wanted to believe, not with her newly recovered health. Kat was spending more and more time with Adrian in L.A. or on set, but she told Maria that she was free to come practice at her apartment when she was out of town. She'd given her a set of keys. Maria took advantage of Kat's empty apartment every chance she got. Sometimes she even spent the night there, though she never told Kat when she did. She didn't necessarily practice much piano. Mostly, she lay on Kat's tufted daybed, read from Kat's library, made tea in Kat's enameled steel kettle. Every little thing Kat owned was beautiful. In a fire, Maria would have taken the small painting of a woman in a bathtub, which hung in the guest room. Debbie choked on a sip of wine, and in the few seconds it took her to catch her breath, Irvin saw an opportunity to open up the conversation. His wife could be hard to stop when she'd had a few, and she always started early when they hosted. A first glass of wine while she gathered ingredients on the counter, a second while dinner simmered, and by the time the guests arrived, she was usually four drinks ahead. Irvin asked everyone what their favorite conspiracy theory was. Jane said global warming, oceans rising. You don't believe in global warming? I thought we were naming things other people don't believe in, Jane said. Every time I hear about oceans rising, I think about the Stephen Wright joke, Bert said. Sponges live in the ocean. I wonder how much deeper it would be if that weren't the case. Maybe the world would be saved if we grew more sponges, Jane said. Or just one very big sponge, Catherine said. She said her favorite conspiracy theory was that Elvis was alive. Irvin said Roswell and Bert said God, which made Maria uneasy. Not that she believed in God, but her parents had, and she'd tried it herself a handful of times. It was going to be her turn to share. She didn't have a favorite conspiracy theory. What did that even mean? She thought her friends might not insist that she come up with an answer, though. One good thing about her illness was that people had mostly stopped trying to change her mind once she said no. Whenever she said no now, everyone assumed the no came from a place of knowledge they couldn't access, that it was the no of someone who'd seen not exactly the future, but something akin to the future, a shortcut to the end, and who knew what it was worth her time and what wasn't. Well, what about you, Maria? Irvin asked. What's your favorite conspiracy theory? She thought of her parents, who hadn't believed in evolution, who'd tried to tell her when she had expressed a desire to become a paleontologist after seeing Jurassic Park, that fossils had been placed on Earth by God in order to test people's faith. Would her parents have called the existence of dinosaurs a conspiracy theory? Would saying dinosaurs be an insult to her parents' memory? The cake was still untouched at the center of the table. Why is it called a princess cake? Maria asked. But Catherine's phone rang before Debbie could look for an answer on the internet, and because it was Adrian calling, everyone went quiet, trying to hear the famous actor's voice. Adrian's in town, Catherine said. Well, I thought he wasn't coming till Sunday, Bert said. Adrian had taken an earlier flight to surprise Catherine, but had found no one at her place. Can he come over? She asked Debbie. Maybe he'll eat the whole cake. Adrian can eat anything. The mood shifted in an instant. They were going to meet a movie star. Jane and Debbie both pretended they had to pee and took turns in the bathroom to reapply their makeup. When Adrian arrived, Debbie brought him a small plate and a spoon from the kitchen, even though he could have used any clean plate or spoon already on the table. This looks amazing, Adrian said. Did you make it yourself? Debbie blushed and said, don't be silly. She cut him too big a slice, and as she did that, she thought the cake now looked worse than a tit, looked like a mangled tit. Adrian made appreciative sounds the moment the cake entered his mouth, and Maria assumed that he was acting. Not enough time had passed for flavor to register in his brain. Jane brought him into the fold by asking what his favorite conspiracy theory was, and Adrian didn't take a beat to think about it or pretend that the question surprised him. His favorite conspiracy theory was that he had a secret twin. With every new film he made, he explained, speculation erupted online as to which twin had done the work. "That's creepy," Bert said. "I don't think I've heard that theory." "The worst part is, I think my therapist believes it," Adrian said. "I feel like she's always trying to trick me, always quizzing me to see if I remember this or that from a previous session." "Well, why don't you fire her?" "Because she's really good. She helps me keep the right boundaries between my characters and my true self." Maria and Debbie met eyes over the cake. Neither of them found the concept of therapy interesting. They knew this about each other. Debbie, besides despising the idea of self-knowledge, believed that she was too complicated for therapy. Maria felt the opposite, that one needed an interesting personality to take to a shrink, and that she didn't have one. Her dreams didn't contain sophisticated layers of meaning, for example. Before a trip, she dreamed that she was packing a suitcase. Every time she quit smoking, she had pleasant dreams in which she smoked. "I think that's more of a rumor than a conspiracy theory," Catherine said about Adrian's secret twin. "What's the difference?" "Well, I've always wondered how rumors start," Jane said. They thought about it as a group. Did a rumor start the moment someone came up with a story? The powerful men in an office? The bored children behind a tree? Or did it start only once a certain number of strangers had heard it? What was that number? It had to be tricky, launching a rumor into the world which you knew would get warped and amended, something whose nature it was to be distorted. The main beats of the story had to be foolproof. The first people you told it to had to be picked with utmost care. Bert wondered how many rumors got nipped in the bud. For every successful one, how many failed to take off? "And why did the rumor that I have a twin make it?" Adrian asked. "What's so fascinating about that?" Maria figured that he wasn't comfortable when a conversation strayed from him for too long. "Are you kidding?" Irvin said. "Two Adrian Careys? That's the definition of hope for the ladies." "And the gentlemen," Catherine added. "Adrian is quite popular among the LGBTQ community." They agreed that rumors, like conspiracy theories, played on hope. Hope that there was always more to uncover. More to life than they'd been told. More meaning. More life. Everything had to be more than it was, to have a secret layer that only truly enlightened people could see. Even the darkest of conspiracy theories held a promise. "I guess I can see the hope in the twin theory," Debbie admitted, "or even in Roswell. But where's the promise in Flat Earth?" "Oh, Lord, not this again. I'm serious. Who would feel better if we suddenly were to find out that the Earth is indeed flat?" "The hope is to discover that everyone has been lying to you," Catherine said, "which then gives you an explanation as to why your life sucks. The hope is to put the blame on someone else." "It gives you a chance to give up, too," Jane added. "If everything you were told is a lie, then you're free to give up on the sheep life you've been living and start anew. It's the ultimate fantasy." "I don't have that fantasy," Bert said. "Why does everyone always want to quit what they're doing?" "I don't know, Einstein. Why did you quit med school? Because it's hard?" "That's not why I quit." "Everything's fun for a minute, then it gets hard," Jane insisted. Maria wanted to ask why Bert had quit med school, but Adrian jumped in before she could. "I just played a heart surgeon in an indie film," he said. "I observed a couple surgeries back in May to prepare for the role. That stuff is wild." Maria's mastectomy had been in May, and though she knew it wasn't her surgery that Adrian had attended, she became uncomfortable at the thought that it could have been. "What type of surgery did you observe?" she asked. Adrian was going for another slice of cake. "Just a couple of valve replacements," he said. "Did you have to ask for the patient's consent?" "They were so psyched to let me watch." Maria struggled to find a response to this. She glanced in Catherine's direction for help. Was her boyfriend serious? Did he really think that his presence had made open-heart surgery better for the patients? But Catherine was focused on the new slice of cake on Adrian's plate. "I'm going out for a cigarette," Maria ended up saying, and her friends looked at one another. Were they supposed to stop her? She had never been a heavy smoker, but after her diagnosis, they'd all been relieved to hear that she'd quit. "You sure you want to do that?" Jane asked. "I didn't know you'd taken it up again." "I'll come out with you, for one," Adrian said. From the balcony, which was right off the dining room, they could have kept participating in the conversation, but Maria slid the glass door shut behind them, which muted her friends. She needed to be away from everyone for a minute. That was, in fact, the main reason she'd started smoking again. A cigarette was an excuse to get out. People, even non-smokers, understood that a smoker needed to take a cigarette break once in a while. What they seldom knew was that the break was also one that the smoker was taking from them. She resented Adrian for following her out. "Can I ask you something?" he said, lighting Maria's cigarette before his. She didn't like it when people lit her cigarettes for her. Lighting your own cigarette was half the fun. "Ask away," she said, then looked down at the street, three floors below. "What do you think Kat sees in me?" Maria wondered what it might feel like to be so self-involved. She doubted it could be all that pleasant. "Well, Catherine's pretty private," she said, unsure why it felt important to use Kat's whole name. "We don't really talk about these things." "Oh, what do you talk about?" Maria thought about that for a moment. The past few weeks, they'd mostly talked about Maria's apartment. She wanted Kat to help her redesign it. She couldn't stand the way it looked anymore. The sad eggshell-colored walls, the smooth kitchen cabinets. "Yeah, neither of us talks very much," she said. The wind in the trees made a sound that reminded her of the hospital, the pillow they'd given her there. Whenever she'd turned her head, the pillow had made this unnerving sound, something between a ruffle and a squeak, like it was filled with styrofoam bits. "We did talk about you once," she remembered. "I asked her about actors, if she thought it was easier for actors to accept the idea of death because their youth had been recorded on film, their energy preserved forever." "Forever?" Adrian said. "Who believes in that?" He said he didn't think humans were going to last very much longer. His youth, as Maria had put it, would exist on film for a while, but soon no one would be left to watch it. "All humans fantasize that their generation will be the last," Maria said. "Believe me, I'm aware. I work in Hollywood. Every other script I get is an end-of-the-world story. The movie I'm shooting right now is an end-of-the-world story." Maria showed no curiosity about the plot, so Adrian went on. "I didn't say we were going to be the last. Maybe humans will stick around for thousands and thousands of years. But it's a known fact that we will disappear at some point. We don't know how yet, that's the whole thrill, but we know that we will. And then what difference will it make that I was once young and did my own stunts in Last Pursuit, or that I was in the film adaptation of Cat's Cradle?" Maria had never seen any of Adrian's movies. She didn't suspect they were very good. "Well, I think after someone dies, there's solace to be found in moving images," she said. "For the family, at least." Adrian said that she might be right. His mother had died when he was young, and he found it sad sometimes that there was no footage of her, only a few photos, and photos didn't help you remember someone as well as home videos did. "What did your mother die of?" Maria asked. "Cancer." "What kind?" He hesitated to say it. "The kind you had." So Kat had told him a bit about her. Maria looked away from the street and at Adrian, but she couldn't make out his expression. There were no lights on in the balcony, and his face was turned toward the moon and a flock of birds heading for a warmer climate. "I wonder if birds also have conspiracy theories," Adrian said. He'd read somewhere that people who studied birdsong had noticed slight changes in a flock's repertoire after certain migrations, as if bird stories and vocabulary were amended according to what they'd learned from a trip. I wonder if they have gossip. Do you like birds? Not really, he said. They creep me out a bit. Me too, Maria said. Especially since dead birds had started showing up on the sidewalks again, she added, as they did at this time of year. She'd seen her first dead warbler of the season just the day before, and that always felt like a bad omen. She couldn't understand why migratory birds insisted on flying through Chicago on their way south. Studies had shown that Chicago was the most dangerous place for them. Every fall, they got confused by the lights and reflections. Every fall, thousands of them hit windows and died. It seemed as if their bird song should have included "Avoid Chicago" by now, she told Adrian. Avoid Chicago at all costs. But maybe Chicago is part of their mythology, he objected. Maybe their vocabulary does include something about the dangers of Chicago, and they know something bad might happen there, but it has to be part of the journey. Like, they know that it's dangerous the way we know that smoking and drinking are dangerous, but we still do it. The wind in the leaves made that styrofoam sound again. Maria shivered. When she came home from the hospital, she threw away all her pillows. She'd ended up not using the noisy hospital one, and so she realized that pillows weren't necessary for sleep, as she'd been led to believe they were since childhood, that the human need for pillows was just another lie. The real question, though, Adrian said, is, do birds know that they're dinosaurs and that they've been around so much longer than us? Do they have any clue? Maria found it odd, this shift to dinosaurs. Adrian's commitment, since he'd stepped out on the balcony, to talk about the nothingness of humanity, the specks of dust they all were, made her question if he treated every change of locale as a new scene. He'd seemed so interested in himself back at the table. I used to wonder about that, too, she admitted. I used to wonder if birds carried some kind of collective memory of the asteroid. Right. We always talk about the species that were wiped out. We mourn the T-Rexes and the Brontosauruses. But when I was a kid, I was obsessed with the ones that remained, the birds and the turtles, the fungi. I always wondered what it must have been like for them to survive all those years alone in the dark, if they carried any sense of responsibility or guilt. I think they did. I think they still might. Maybe that's why I find it hard to look at them for too long. They embody a form of regret, what the world could have been. Maria thought his last line cheesy and stilted, something he might have read in a bad script. But then maybe it was hard not to be cheesy when you talked about birds. My parents believed that the world was 6,000 years old, she said. They might have also believed that birds merely sang, she realized now, were constantly cutely singing, not alerting one another to potential dangers, not retelling old stories and cautionary tales. 6,000 years is still a good chunk of time, Adrian said. It's still a frightening amount to consider. Maria thought that was a nice thing to say, or maybe it was condescending to her parents. She couldn't tell. Her cigarette was almost finished, and she didn't want to go back inside thinking about her parents or about time, how much there had been and how much was left. She asked Adrian what it was that she saw in Catherine. Adrian turned toward the window, as if he needed to look at his girlfriend to remember what he liked about her. She and Debbie were animated in conversation, Debbie making hand gestures like, "Let me stop you right there," Catherine leaning forward to say what she was going to say. "Cat, she doesn't think about this stuff," Adrian said. "She doesn't think about geological eras, what she's bigger or smaller than. She's content. It's an amazing thing to see." Maria wondered if he knew about the metabolism tracking device. It didn't seem to be on the table anymore. Perhaps Cat had hidden it before he arrived. Catherine broke up with Adrian before the end of his first week in Chicago. Back at her place, after filming a stunt in which his character was thrown through a bay window, he'd talked for too long about his nostalgia for sugar glass, a type of prop that had been replaced by something called breakaway glass. He just didn't like the resin in the breakaway glass as much. The stunts weren't as fun. Cat Catherine couldn't find it in her to pretend to care. The split was amicable. Adrian moved into Soho House that very night. He was supposed to spend the next few days filming action scenes on Lower Wacker Drive, but heavy rain flooded it and production adjusted the schedule. A monologue that Adrian had been dreading was moved up by 3 weeks. He was now expected to give it to the camera in about an hour. "You're right," he said to the mirror in his dressing room. "I am a physicist." Would the audience believe this? Well, Adrian reasoned, they would already have been asked to buy the idea that, after Russia tested secret new weapons in Siberia, the Earth had started spinning faster on its axis. "I understand the science," he went on. "I know what is happening. What I don't know is how to explain it to my kid. I don't know how to tell my kid that if the Earth keeps spinning faster and faster, that if the numbers keep rising at the pace we've been seeing, it won't just be satellites going off track. It won't just be shorter days and constant jet lag, tsunamis and plants dying and horses going mad. If my projections are correct, we will reach terminal acceleration in a week. We'll become weightless, which will be fun, sure, but only for a split second before we start flying around like bloody, literally bloody, confetti. We'll hit the walls in our houses and die. We will collide with buildings as if we're outside, or trees, or other bodies, already dead bodies just floating in the air. Is that what I should tell my kid? How do I get him ready for this? I'm a physicist, yes, but I'm a father first. Now, tell me, what equations can I solve to prepare my boy for this kind of death?" Later in the script, Adrian's character did have a talk with his son, another 20 lines he wasn't looking forward to learning, especially given how much he disliked the child actor they had cast to play the son. The kid had been chosen for his resemblance to Adrian, supposedly, but Adrian couldn't see it, was insulted that production hadn't found a better match. His assistant knocked on the door. They were waiting for him on set. Walking to the soundstage, Adrian heard a flapping noise and looked up at the 35-foot ceilings. He spotted two pigeons amid the rigging, looking down at the set. Their puffy chests brought to mind plump ladies at the opera, passing judgment from the comfort of a private box. He was not fond of pigeons, but seeing birds where they shouldn't be always cheered him for a moment. There was security to go through to get into CineSpace, but the pigeons hadn't bothered with it. Maybe they'd take the L and go to an indoor mall later, or to the airport, or to the movies. He'd never seen a bird in a movie theater, but it had to have happened. The makeup artist did some touch-up to his forehead, and Adrian tried to focus on his lines to get in the zone. The only thing he liked about the script was a scene, much later on, in which his character prepares for the erosion of gravitational power by strapping pillows against his and his kid's chests, arms, and legs. He looked forward to shooting that scene and the ones that would follow, in which he'd hang from cables in front of a green screen, padded in pillows. He hadn't known Maria when he first read the script. He hadn't even known Catherine. And he would only ever think of her once more when the time came to shoot that pillow scene. When they'd gone back inside after their cigarette, Maria had told the table about her newfound discovery that people didn't need pillows to sleep. She presented her act of throwing away all her pillows as a grand cathartic gesture, a step toward freedom. But her friends looked troubled by it. She couldn't go to bed without pillows, they said. They all seemed to believe it was unthinkable. Adrian stood on his mark and waited for the director's go. The pigeons were still up there, but they were restless now. They seemed to have sensed that something was about to happen. Perhaps they were debating flying down towards the set for front row seats. The set today was a physics lab. There were many fine details, but there was also a gigantic periodic table of the elements hanging on the wall. Adrian didn't think that a real physicist would have a poster of the periodic table in his lab. But his doubts had been brushed away. "It communicates," the director said. And now, from the December 17, 2025 online edition of The New Yorker, The year in slop. This was the year that AI-generated content passed a kind of audiovisual Turing test, sometimes fooling us against our better judgment, by Kyle Chaika. The Turing test, a long-established tool for measuring machine intelligence, gauges the point at which a text-generating machine can fool a human into thinking it's not a robot. ChatGPT passed that benchmark earlier this year, inaugurating a new technological era, though not necessarily one of superhuman intelligence. More recently, however, artificial intelligence passed another threshold, a kind of Turing test for the eye. The images and videos that AI can produce are now sometimes indistinguishable from real ones, as new image-friendly models were trained, refined, and released by companies including OpenAI, Meta, and Google. The online public gained the ability to instantly generate realistic AI content on any theme they could imagine, from superhero fan art and cute animals to scenes of violence and war. Slop, the term of not art for content churned out with AI, became ubiquitous in 2025. Inspiring new sub-coinages such as slopper, derogatory shorthand for someone who relies on AI to think for them. Slop went beyond the realms of surreal amusement or frivolous entertainment. The relatively anodyne days of bizarre, obviously fake shrimp Jesus images in Facebook feeds are gone. In 2025, the President of the United States relied on AI, Ajit Slop, to promote his policies and taunt his detractors. And other politicians followed suit. Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, became a kind of omnipresent mascot on Sora, his own company's social media feed of slop. Not all of the content was convincing, but a lot of it came close enough. And in our increasingly audiovisual digital world, that may turn out to represent a more significant Rubicon than the Turing test. OpenAI Studio Ghibli Factory. It seems almost quaint in retrospect. Toward the beginning of the year, OpenAI released its updated GPT-4o model, which had the ability to generate still images within the ChatGPT text window. One of the demos was used to promote the product was a group selfie of Sam Altman and a couple of his collaborators transformed into a drawing in the style of the legendary Japanese animator Hayao Miyazaki of the animation house Studio Ghibli. The model was shockingly good at mimicking Studio Ghibli's organic, eminently human aesthetic. The trick went viral, and the internet was flooded with Ghibli slop, consisting of random images frictionlessly turned into anime. A foreboding low was reached when the White House's X account cynically exploited the meme to promote its roundup of immigrants, sharing a Ghiblified image showing the arrest of a brown-skinned woman labeled an alien fellow convicted of fentanyl trafficking. The AI Bible. In May, Google released VO3, an AI video generation model that could spit out 8-second-long photorealistic clips. A couple months later, an outfit called AI Bible published an 8-minute video on YouTube that rendered The Rapture in AI graphics that looked like outtakes from Game of Thrones. No prestige TV budget was required, only the patience to type prompts into a text box. This slopocalypse racked up more than 800,000 views, suggesting how readily online audiences would embrace vacant facsimiles as must-see TV. Animals jumping on trampolines. AI, like an audiovisual genie, can perform wish fulfillment, depicting fantastical things that we'd like to believe were true, and testing our willingness to suspend disbelief. In June, a man in California captured real-life videos of coyotes wandering onto a trampoline and playfully bouncing. That footage inspired a frenzy of AI videos showing other animals jumping onto trampolines in ways that would surely defy credibility if they weren't so delightful. Rabbits hopping higher than usual, moose performing flips, bears boinging until the mat gives out. Some of this footage passed as real in part because it used the aesthetic of infrared surveillance cameras, showing shadowy creatures at night. Those who paid close attention might have noticed that the animals tended to appear from nowhere and multiply or disappear. But, of course, when you're scrolling through a video feed, there's little incentive to look twice. Sam Altman stealing GPUs. At first, slop was a widely derided format, the kind of clicky nonsense churned out by content farms or trolls. But in September, with the launch of OpenAI's Sora app, a social network and feed for AI-generated videos, the company set about convincing users that slop was something we should all be making for fun. Sora allowed you to turn yourself into a kind of AI puppet to be adopted and remixed by other users at will. Altman made himself a test subject for the feature, resulting in one of the most popular videos across the new platform. A clip of Altman stealing GPUs, graphics processing units, which are needed to run AI, from shelves in a Target store and being apprehended by a security guard. The footage was intended as a joke, but a convincing deep fake of someone carrying out a crime is exactly the kind of thing that should scare us. Andrew Cuomo's anti-Mamdani slop. AI's new talent for making realistic videos was quickly marshaled as a political weapon. In October, the mayoral campaign of the former governor Andrew Cuomo released an AI-generated ad featuring criminals for Zohran Mamdani, a cast of characters from wife-beater to shoplifter, based on crude and often racist stereotypes, all of them espousing their support for the now mayor-elect. The video, which the campaign quickly deleted, demonstrated AI's uncanny ability to render a realism devoid of ethics. It's hard to imagine human actors agreeing to cooperate with such a ludicrously offensive script. Not long after the ad's release, social media accounts under the name Citizens Against Mamdani cropped up, showing supposed locals railing loudly against the stupid voters who had led Mamdani to victory. This apparent attempt to astroturf an anti-Mamdani movement was cut short when some of the accounts were labeled as AI and taken down. Even more than the criminals for Zohran, these faux New Yorkers were frighteningly realistic. Trump's flying excrement and medbed slop. Donald Trump began the year sharing an AI video of Trump Gaza, a redeveloped cityscape of the Palestinian territory stocked with golden statues of himself. It had been generated by two Israeli-American filmmakers to satirize Trump's idea to turn Gaza into a Riviera of the Middle East. But for Trump, it was simply a useful mock-up of his vision. The president's budding affinity for AI videos came into full flower in October when he shared a generated clip of himself piloting a bomber jet emblazoned with the words King Trump and dumping what looked like feces on No Kings protesters. The video, relatively cartoonish, but nevertheless disgusting, would likely have remained a bit of bizarre internet ephemera if it hadn't been posted by the actual commander-in-chief, presumably as a demonstration of what he wished he could do to his opponents. Another generated clip that Trump shared around the same time showed him on Laura Trump's Fox News show, extolling hospitals specializing in the imaginary, conspiracy theory-derived miracle technology known as med beds. Either Trump was somehow unaware that the footage was manufactured, or he knowingly chose to promote it nonetheless, Either way, it was deep fake news. The Christmas slop mural on the Thames. As slop becomes ever easier to generate, it is moving off of our screens and into physical spaces. In November, the residents of the outer London town of Kingston upon Thames were shocked to find that a huge holiday mural installed in a downtown shopping district mixed Christmas cheer with AI horror. The scenes were meant to depict a winter fair held on the frozen over river. The participants, however, were mutant dog-bird hybrids, snowmen with too many eyes, and humanoid bodies packed into an impossibly dense morass. Rumored to have been rendered by the British artist Matt Coleshaw and commissioned by a local landlord, the mural sparked political controversy. Did they present some veiled commentary on immigration and were soon torn down? One townsperson did appreciate the work, however, describing it as so bad, it's good. McDonald's Pure AI ad. If 2025 marked the mainstreaming of slop, it also ushered in an accompanying slop backlash. The shallowness, the glitches, and the too-smooth textures of AI content became symbols of chicanery mixed with laziness. This month, McDonald's Netherlands released a holiday advertisement created entirely with AI, titled, "It's the Most Terrible Time of the Year." Depicting various holiday snafus, toppling Christmas trees, baking disasters, carolers caught in a snowstorm, the solution, according to the ad, is to walk into a warm, cozy, unreal McDonald's restaurant and hide out until January. Both for its negative take on Yuletide rituals and for its sorry attempt to save on production costs, the ad was so poorly received that the company decided to pull it. McDonald's Netherlands apologized in a statement, acknowledging that, for many of its customers, the holidays are, in fact, the most wonderful time of the year. No one wants to find slop under the Christmas tree. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.